This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up, low-wage workers in Minnesota are set to get a pay increase. Some new gun restrictions go into effect in Minnesota this week as well. It's going to get a little bit more costly if you get caught speeding in a construction zone. And a local activist claims he was assaulted by Minneapolis police during his arrest over the weekend. It's Monday, July 28th. I'm John Wanamaker. Low-wage workers throughout Minnesota get pay raises starting later this week when the state's minimum wage increases for the first time since 2005. Tim Pugmire reports.
The minimum wage will grow in stages over the next 2 years, reaching $9.50 an hour in 2016. The first step comes Friday when the current rate of $6.15 jumps to $8 for large employers. Supporters say the increase will help the economy because low-wage workers will have more to spend. But Ben Gerber of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce warns that businesses will be hurt and jobs will be lost.
There's going to be a lot of people that no matter how much preparation, they're not going to be able to make it work, and those are the businesses that we're concerned about and the employees who work for them.
The bill passed last session also provides for automatic annual inflationary increases, which are set to begin in 2018, with an annual cap of 2.5%. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Two new laws that place tougher restrictions on some people with guns go into effect this week. Brad Williams has more on that.
One of the new laws adds three offenses to the list of so-called crimes of violence. A person convicted of a crime of violence, such as assault or robbery, is banned for life in Minnesota from legally possessing firearms. The other law requires a person who's been ordered by the courts to stay away from a domestic partner to surrender his or her firearms while the case moves through the system. Under the law, people under domestic violence restraining orders can give their weapons to law enforcement agencies, licensed gun dealers, or eligible third parties. Senator Ron Latz, a Democrat from St. Louis Park, co-sponsored the bill, which received bipartisan support.
We can get good things done when people are willing to work together on these issues.
Gun rights advocates say they didn't oppose the two bills because they don't punish law-abiding gun owners. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Drivers caught speeding in construction zones in Minnesota will soon be looking at a heftier ticket. Starting Friday, the offense comes with an automatic $300 fine plus the normal traffic ticket surcharges. That's under a new state law approved during the legislative session. Officials from the Department of Transportation, a highway contractor, and the State Patrol plan a news conference today to highlight the changes in the law. From 2010 through 2013, there were 31 fatalities in work zone crashes. That, according to the Minnesota Department of Transportation, there were more than 7,200 work zone crashes during that period. The St. Paul Police Department will likely face cuts when Mayor Chris Coleman unveils his budget proposal next month. Documents obtained by NPR News show Coleman asked the department to draw up recommendations for close to $2 million in cuts. That's much bigger than the reductions other city departments had to contemplate. Curtis Gilbert reports.
St. Paul's expenses are growing faster than its revenues. As a result, it faces a budget deficit almost every year. For next year, the deficit is projected to be nearly $10 million. That will shrink a bit, thanks to a boost in state aid to local governments. But Mayor Coleman says just like every year since he took office in 2006, he's asking his department heads for ways to cut spending.
Imagine having to cut every year for the last 8 or 9 years and then say, we need you to cut more. It gets very difficult. And having gone now through this 9 years, I have a fairly good sense going into this process of what our options are. And the reality is there aren't a whole lot of good ones.
So Coleman asked each department to assume a slight reduction in dollars from the city's general fund, a cut of less than half of 1%. But for the police department, he also asked to see what a much larger 2% cut would look like. That would reduce the department budget by more than $1.8 million. In a presentation to the mayor last month, the department said it could make that cut without laying off cops, but it would have to get rid of a dozen civilian employees and eliminate technological innovations that would save money in the long run. In an interview following a community meeting last week, Coleman said closing the deficit will mean controlling costs in public safety.
I mean, the fact of the matter is police and fire make up about 2/3 of the budget of the city of St. Paul. So in the past, we've cut a lot out of parks in particular. We've cut a lot out of various general fund services while we've added additional resources, including the additional money that we put into the crime lab last year for the police department. And so the fact is it will impact the department. You know, our goal is to not have it impact feet on the street.
Whenever somebody from a local government says we're not going to cut boots on the ground, that's not completely accurate.
Officer Dave Titus is the president of the St. Paul Police Federation, and he says when the department cuts civilian employees, the burden of doing paperwork just shifts onto sworn officers.
It is going to reduce the amount of time that patrol sergeants will be on the street because their clerical type duties will increase, which they have over the last 10 to 15 years already. And now you're going to compound that. What that really means is we're going to have less ability to investigate crimes.
It's not clear how closely the mayor's actual budget proposal will hew to the recommendations he's received, and his spokesman says he's not trying to single out the police department. But city finance staff say only the police were asked to look at a potential 2% budget cut, and Titus finds that troubling.
The first thing that comes to my mind is that then public safety is not a priority of this mayor's office. Just because we have the largest budget doesn't mean that we can sustain the largest cut.
There is a sliver of agreement between Titus and Coleman. They both think the city could save money by making the police impound lot more efficient. But the budget recommendation from the police department warns steep reductions to civilian staff there would make it impossible to cover the operation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The recommendations from other city departments show it's not just the police that are having trouble trimming spending. A memo from the fire department says bluntly its budget doesn't give it the resources it needs to improve service or provide adequate support to frontline crews. The parks department says even without cuts, it'll face increased budget pressure from the new Saints ballpark, the raise in the state minimum wage, and even Obamacare, which will force it to provide health insurance to more part-time workers. None of this surprises City Council President Kathy Lantry.
I think it's going to be a very difficult budget year, and part of that has to do with pent-up demand.
After years of deficits, all city departments have grown weary of finding things to cut. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
Two lawmakers want more financial oversight of Minnesota's state-run system of colleges and universities. Alex Friedrich has more.
The House and Senate Higher Education Committee chairs are drafting legislation that could require legislative approval of employment agreements for top executives in the system. They're also considering lowering the financial threshold required for board approval of contracted work. Senator Terry Bonoff, a DFLer from Minnetonka, says she's troubled that system officials quietly signed at least two high-priced contracts.
Recent actions have revealed a lack of transparency that's concerning.
The chairman of the House Higher Education Committee says he also wants to hold a joint hearing this year on several concerns, including continued executive bonuses and last year's payroll problems at Metropolitan State University. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Residents in southeastern Minnesota will have three opportunities this week to weigh in on a proposed high-speed rail line between the Twin Cities and Rochester. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Federal, state, and county officials are currently evaluating possible routes for a proposed high-speed service known as Zip Rail. The study area includes a nearly 100-mile corridor that spans seven counties from Rochester to the Twin Cities. Earlier this summer, officials released a broad scoping document that begins to outline the proposed route, alternate routes, and potential environmental concerns with the project. Public information meetings to discuss the document are scheduled on Tuesday in Rochester, Wednesday in Invergrove Heights, and Thursday in Kenyon. The public comment period ends on August 6th. The proposed route is still years from becoming a reality and has not received any funding yet. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
Sheriff's officials in northern Minnesota say a home invasion Saturday ended in a fatal shooting. WDIO-TV reports that authorities say a man came to the door of a home in Couchiching County asking for help. When the female homeowner opened the door, the suspect assaulted her. The homeowner's son then shot the suspect. A deputy arrived and the suspect was taken to Rainy Lake Medical Center, where he later died from his injuries. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is assisting in the investigation. The incident took place at a home about 20 miles southeast of International Falls. A longtime critic of the Minneapolis Police Department is accusing officers of assaulting him over the weekend. Al Flowers says officers came to his house early Saturday morning to arrest a family member and ended up beating him up. Police aren't saying much about the incident, but Mayor Betsy Hodges is asking people to give the city more time to sort out what happened. Peter Cox has more.
Al Flowers says Minneapolis police knocked on his door late Friday to serve a warrant on a 17-year-old daughter. Flowers claims when he asked to see the warrant, the officers would not show it to him. That led to an altercation in which Flowers says he was physically assaulted by police. Minneapolis police claim he assaulted an officer with his fists, bruising the officer, according to police documents. But Flowers denies that.
I assaulted no one. I have staples in my head, stitches in my eye, and this is what it is.
After the incident, police first took Flowers to Hennepin County Medical Center. He was later taken into custody at the Hennepin County Jail. Flowers was released from jail yesterday afternoon. The left side of his face was puffed and bruised, his left eye bloodshot, and his scalp had a large cut. Inside his home on Chicago Avenue near Lake Street, Flowers walked a group of reporters into his living room, where he showed what he says was the aftermath of the fight. Tables and drinking glasses strewn about, a plant knocked over, and couch cushions pulled onto the floor.
Can I get a warrant? And they said no, and then they pushed me there. They pushed me up against the wall, and from there, and they were choking me.
Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto addressed the media at a church on North Broadway Avenue yesterday. She was joined by Mayor Betsy Hodges and several community leaders.
We're here because we're a team, and this is about making Minneapolis a safer city and not undoing what we've done by distractions. This is an incident that shouldn't undo all the great things that have been done. We're asking for people to withhold judgment. We're asking for calmness, and we're asking for peace.
Harto declined to answer questions or go into detail about Flowers' arrest, saying it is an ongoing investigation. Mayor Hodges says she'll work with the police, attorneys, and community.
I know that my role is to keep communication open with the community, and my role is to make sure that I am working with the police department and with the city attorney's office to make sure that we get the best outcome that we can as we follow the legal process.
Flowers' sister, Lisa Clemens, says both Harto and Hodges have reached out since the incident. Flowers' attorney, Bobby Joe Champion, a DFL senator from Minneapolis, says because Flowers has been publicly critical of the police department in the past, it adds another layer to the case.
If he has a history of being critical of the police, then police know him, right? And then police, not all police, but some police officers could have some level of disdain towards him. So they look for any opportunity by which to be a little more aggressive with him because of things he may have said or expectations that we all would have of our police.
Champion says it's unclear if and when Flowers might be charged in court. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
High land costs are often impossible hurdles to overcome for aspiring farmers. 100 acres of good farmland can cost $1 million, and that amount of land is often too little to support a family. But one approach that works for some young farmers is to find a partner. Mark Stile reports.
It's not easy to get a start in farming these days. Consider 37-year-old Ryan Batalden. Batalden is making a living now, but it took him years to get established.
It's really hard. It shouldn't be this difficult to farm.
He, his wife, and three children live near Lamberton in southwest Minnesota. They're organic farmers and raise a variety of crops, as well as pigs, cows, and chickens. Batalden worked for a time in the Twin Cities after graduating from college, but he always felt the tug of the farm.
I was in a cubicle, and I just couldn't deal with it. I didn't really have any direction. I knew I had to work outside.
So he left the office job and went to work on his parents' farm about 12 years ago. He also looked for opportunities to start his own farm. He was able to rent 80 acres, but that wasn't enough to support him and his family. He couldn't find any other affordable land to rent, and buying meant spending over $3,000 an acre, something that was also out of reach. But then, about 7 years ago, just when it looked like full-time farming might remain just a dream, Batalden responded to what turned out to be a life-changing email.
Supposedly, this guy was trying to get some investors who want to invest in farmland linked up with organic and sustainable farmers.
This guy was Robert Karp, who runs a Wisconsin-based organization, New Spirit Farmland Partnerships. Karp remembers when he first called the young Minnesota farmer.
Ryan Brian was very appealing because he'd already been farming for 5 years. He'd grown up on an organic farm, so he had a lot of experience. And we could just see that he was a young man who knew what he was doing.
His group had an investor who was looking to buy farmland and rent it back to an organic farmer. After a search, the investor was able to buy 160 acres near Ryan Batalden. Batalden leased the land at a cost below the rental price of neighboring property. A few years later, the same thing was done with a second purchase, this one for 100 acres. So Batalden now farms 260 acres with the assistance of CARP's program, enough to support a family. CARP says he's also helped match five other farmers around the U.S. with investors.
It's a unique moment to have so many young people interested in agriculture, and we should be trying to help as many of them as we can find their way into farming.
CARP says his is a relatively small-scale effort, though, and more needs to be done. Other organizations are also working to help young farmers, including Minnesota-based Land Stewardship Project. Karen Stettler oversees LSP's Farm Beginnings program. She says it helps evaluate and instruct young farmers on what they need to do to get started.
The Farm Beginnings program really helps people to think about their deeply held values and beliefs, put that into a goal, and then to also make sure to follow that goal up with helping them to assess finances and marketing strategies.
She says over the past 17 years, about 600 people have gone through the program, and about 60% are still farming. Southwest Minnesota farmer Ryan Batalden says he knows he was lucky to find the help he needed to expand his farming operation. But he says with the average age of the U.S. farmer approaching 60, more needs to be done to get young farmers started.
I don't know who we think is going to farm all this land, because as the baby boomers move off the land, we're going to need a lot more people.
Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, near Lamberton.
The nonprofit group Loaves and Fishes says it served more than 41,000 free meals in June. That's more than any other month in the organization's 32-year history. Most of the increased demand came from families with children. Executive Director Kathy Mays says summer is usually a busier time at community meal sites because children are out of school, but she says she thinks this year has been especially busy because her team spent more time promoting their program to school kids and crafting meals that are more appealing to them.
I think once kids are comfortable coming to Loaves and Fishes, they think of us as a restaurant or a school cafeteria where good food is served, and they come back.
Loaves and Fishes also opened 6 additional lunch sites in the metro area 2 months ago. Mays says the meal program will expand into Eagan and Invergrove Heights this fall. And finally, the University of Minnesota Duluth has received a $9 million federal grant to conduct geological drilling in Antarctica. Professor John Googe says the project will enable researchers to gather ice and bedrock samples to an extent not seen before.
What we would like to be able to find is evidence of Antarctica's geology that relates to the formation and breakup of supercontinents that we can then use as a way to understand the Earth's global system of tectonics.
Researchers will also analyze ice samples to better understand climate change over hundreds of thousands of years. The grant funds construction and testing of the drilling platform. Drilling should begin in late 2017. And that's the NPR News update for Monday, July 28th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.